There's never a cop around when you need one. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast whose audience figures suggest that I may be the last man on Earth. Now, Charlton Heston was always yesterday's man or tomorrow's man, but never a man for today. That at least was the conclusion of the Hollywood producers who only seemed to cast him in historical epics set thousands of years in the past or catapulted him into the future in a string of science fiction films. Just look at the record. Between Ben-Hur in 1959 and the film we're reviewing here, Chucky made just two films with a present-day setting. The toothy hunk may have ached to star in humdrum contemporary dramas, but the poor sod was always ending up struggling with wedgie woes in tight spandex or trying to hide his gonads as he undertook action scenes in a skimpy toga. So, because you don't get many exploding helicopters in biblical dramas, we're looking at one of his sci-fi outings, 1971's The Omega Man. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a woman who always dresses for dinner on Sunday. It's Erica Schultz from Customers Also Watched. Welcome to the show, Erica.
Hi, Will. Thanks for having me.
No, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here, because a few months back you were very kind to invite me onto your show to talk about the excellent 1970s thriller Black Sunday, which very conveniently for me, very fortunately for me, had an exploding helicopter in. So thank you for pandering to my predilections. But do you want to, for people who might not be familiar with your show, do you want to take a moment to tell people about your show and explain the concept?
Sure, of course. And again, thank you for being a guest for the Black Sunday episode. You were the first person I thought of being the world's leading expert on exploding helicopters. So Customers Also Watched is a podcast that strictly covers movies that are streaming on Amazon Prime. I started about 2 years ago, picked one movie from my personal watch list, and from there I pick a movie from the Customers Also Watch list of every movie I cover. So it's been an unbroken trail of pick a movie, watch it, review it, then pick a movie from that movie's list, and so on and so forth. I actually also have a second podcast now that I started last year called Unsung Horrors, which is just a horror movie review podcast where my co-host and I cover horror movies which have fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd.
Cool. And focusing on Customers Also Watched, for a moment, you explained the concept behind it, which is it's a very neat way of navigating all of that content that is available through that platform. But until I started listening, what I hadn't quite appreciated was you need to be quite strategic in your sort of journey through, because you don't want to end up in a bit of a dead end, or a kind of a cul-de-sac of content that you're not particularly keen on.
Yeah, exactly. It's not just about picking a movie that I want to watch. I also need to think ahead and think, well, what could possibly be on the list for this movie? So I have definitely gotten into the dregs of what's on Amazon Prime. But I've also had some really high points where I got a good, a good run of 70s movies that I really enjoyed, including Black Sunday. And so it's an interesting ride. And I'm hoping to keep it going for a while.
Well, you mentioned the 1970s there, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you've got a bit of a passion for 70s cinema. And, I wondered, is there something about the films from that decade that you're particularly drawn to? And if so, what is it?
There's a few things, depending on the genre. I think the 70s for me has the... First of all, it has most of my favorite movies are from that decade. And a lot of that has to do with the realism from that. You've got the new Hollywood films coming out. Practical effects are huge for me. I am not a fan of CGI. I think it has its place and can help enhance certain things, but especially when it comes to horror movies, which is my favorite genre, the 70s are just kind of where it's at for me. And I also like... and this kind of goes across many different genres, but the downbeat endings. I'm not a fan of let's tie it all up in a bow very nice and neatly and make everyone happy when they leave the theater. I like I don't want to say depressing movies, but I like walking away with something to think about or not feeling good after a movie is over.
Well, if you know, if you like horror movies and you like the 1970s, I mean, there were a lot of great horror movies made in that particular decade. And yeah, as you say, it does seem to be there did seem to be an attempt for, I don't know, I guess more adult endings in films, ones which kind of attributed a bit more perhaps intelligence or complexity to the audience that, yeah. You know, we don't necessarily need to see justice done, or that every single plot strand needs to be tied up with a neat bow.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, treating your audience with some kind of respect, making them think about it, and it's just I appreciate when I'm given that from a film, where it lets me think about it and figure things out on my own. I don't have to have everything handed to me. They don't have kids' gloves in those movies.
Okay, I think it's time we got stuck into the Amiga Man. So let's see if Trailer Man can tell us a bit about The Last Man on Earth.
The last man on Earth lives in a fortress.
Discovery check. How does that grab you, Caesar?
The last man on Earth always carries an automatic weapon. The last man on Earth is hunting. Because the last man on Earth is not alone. Charlton Heston, Rosalind Cash.
Charlton Heston plays the sole-ish human survivor of a terrible biological war that has killed most of the human race. All that remain are marauding gangs of albino-looking mutants who can only emerge at night due to their light-sensitive eyes. When Heston discovers other human survivors and realizes there might be a cure for the virus, the stage is set for a deadly confrontation against the mutants with the survival of the human race at stake. In the cast, we have Charlton Heston, Rosalind Cash, and Anthony Zerbe. The film was directed by Boris Segal, who didn't direct many films, but he did have a very extensive career in television. And if you're a Trivia and Sons of Anarchy fan, he's the father of Katie Segal, a.k.a. Gemma Teller, in that show. The film is based on the novel I Am Legend by the noted writer Richard Matheson, who's very extensive career of writing credits in television, film, and it was also a novelist as well. This is the second of, or possibly actually more adaptations of this particular book. Let's go with that number for the moment. This is the second of three adaptations, the first being 1964's The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price, and then more recently we had I Am Legend with Will Smith. The Amiga Man has a 6.5 rating on IMDb and a 53% audience rating on IMDb. So with all of that out of the way, Erica, what did you make of The Amiga Man?
It is probably, well, having, I know we'll get to sort of all of the adaptations of it. Having not seen I Am Legend, and I'm sticking with that, I won't see it. it's not my favorite adaptation. I do very much enjoy the first third of it with Heston traipsing around a desolate Los Angeles and picking out a new car and going to the movies and talking to himself and playing chess with a mannequin. And I appreciate the direction that the screenwriters were trying to take with it. It's interesting, the screenwriters were a husband and wife duo, and the husband, John Carrington, he was a very sort of spiritual person. He's a poet, and his wife was a biochemist. And so you can kind of see elements from their personal background coming into that. And, you know, I think that's probably why they made the choice to have it be biological warfare versus a virus, which is what it is in the book and Last Man on Earth and the other adaptations. But I appreciate the direction that they were trying to make making it relevant to the modern movements of the time, but doing so makes it extremely dated to me. And there is just zero subtlety in this movie. It beats you over the head with its messages and its imagery. And so again, sort of getting back to what we were talking about a little earlier with not needing to be fed, you know, these ideas and being able to think about it. This just is like, you get it, you get it, you get it. Like,
it's sledgehammer filmmaking, isn't it?
It very much so is, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm in a similar place to yourself because, you know, I hadn't seen this for a long time, actually, before this rewatch. And I think I had either overlooked or just completely forgotten what an odd film this is, because it is a real mishmash of styles and ideas, some of which work like quite well, and other bits are terrible. And to the, you know, one of the points that you made, this is a film that has not dated, you know, very well either, I think, on a technical point in terms of the look of the film or in its, some of its, you know, thematic ideas. And I think overall I found it quite frustrating, I think, for that reason, because there are a lot of ideas within it and picks up on what would have been very relevant cultural ideas from the early 70s, a fear of World War III. You know, this was the Cold War, the, you know, hippie culture, quite where that was in terms of, you know, the public consciousness. I'm not quite sure by 1971, but certainly, you know, very fresh in the minds of the audience. And then, you know, you have a sort of taboo busting interracial relationship in this film. So you've got all of these like interesting sort of ideas in the film, but they didn't really feel coherent. They didn't mesh together. And I didn't really sense there was a strong authorial voice at work in this particular film, and, you know, or a kind of overarching, you know, philosophy. I mean, how does that sound to you?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think they very much tried to ham-fist this idea of the fear of the hippie culture and cults, because that was very sort of top of mind. This is coming out fairly recently after the Manson murders. So that's in there as well. The screenwriters had said that Cash being cast in this movie and written as a Black woman was very deliberate because of the Black Power movement at the time. But again, it feels forced. It feels like they're trying to push that message so hard, but they're not doing it very effectively.
No, they don't really do anything with it. So, you know, they have her character in the film and we see her start a relationship with Charlton Heston, and that at that time would have been quite unusual. You know, certainly Omega Man, I think from after Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in 1967 or 68, that seemed to, you know, there had been other films prior to that that had looked at, you know, interracial couples. But, you know, after that, that seemed to really sort of open the door and more films started to tackle that subject matter. But here, you know, they kind of throw it into the pot, but they don't stir it around. They don't do anything particularly interesting with it.
Yeah, I agree completely. I was surprised. I hadn't remembered, because the first time I saw it, I was a teenager, so I'm coming up on, you know, 25 plus years now, and I remember vaguely liking it as a kid, but also not having the cultural context of the time to go into it and thinking what was going on with that. But looking at it now, it doesn't seem like they knew what to do with those ideas. And this is the screenwriter's only screenwriting credit. And they just decided this was how they were going to do it, but they didn't know how to send a message with that. You mentioned Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. That movie has a very clear message in it to make you think about it. Whereas this one is just a man versus, you know, hippie cults. And, oh, let's throw in these other plots and or these other elements to it to try to speak to our modern audience. But when you do that, you are automatically putting a timestamp on your movie and dating it, and it's not going to hold up over time versus something like The Last Man on Earth, which, you know, the performances are very different between Price and Heston. But I think Last Man on Earth is something that I can revisit time after time because it doesn't try to pull in those politics. It's trying, Omega Man tries to do too much, you know, trying to have those political and or those socio-political messages in the film in a story like this, where the original source material was not political. It was more about a man's own desperation and realizing that he is the last of his kind and he is no longer relevant. And so it just loses the message of the original source text, which I think is probably my biggest problem with it.
Well, let's dig a little bit more into the sort of social commentary that's woven into this film. We've already spoken a bit about the relationship between Rosalind Cash and Charlton Heston in this film. You know, there are also some other sort of nods towards. I mean, there are also some nods towards what you would call, you know, the hippie culture. So we see Charlton Heston go into a cinema, which, you know, he has got up and running again. And, mm-hmm. you know, he sits down in there and I really don't know why, but he is rewatching the Woodstock, the movie. And, you know, as he's watching it, we see him sort of mechanically, you know, repeat some of the vox pop interviews they're doing as part of that film, where people are, you know, sort of talking about their aspirations for peace and brotherly love. And later in the film, well, when we meet Matthias's character, the leader of this cult-like group of mutants, that they're described as the family. And, you know, I guess you could see, you know, Manson as the darker side of that kind of, you know, 60s movement. And again, sort of, you know, I guess those ideas, I guess you get the contrast there between this wrecked world that Charlton Heston is living in. But again, I wasn't really sure, you know, is this a critique of hippie culture, or is other, as we've just spoken about, you know, previously, are they just, you know, sort of ticking a box? Oh, here's a contemporary cultural reference we can make.
Yeah. And I think it just gets back to, I don't think even the screenwriters wanted to know. You're right. It's ticking boxes. It's like, you know, what's socially relevant right now? Well, hippie culture, Black Power movement, interracial relationships. And it's just not executed well at all. I have no problem with remaking The Last Man on Earth, or even just another adaptation of the original source material. But what they're trying to do with it, just, it doesn't work. I can't say it any better than you. It's just, let's just check off some boxes here and throw it in the movie. And, but they don't put it in a blender. Like you said, they don't mix it up.
They really don't. They really don't. Well, we have been quite critical of this film, but I think there are some things that we definitely did like about it. And you mentioned that, you know, you liked the start of the film, or the first third of the film. What aspects of that part of the film was it that you thought that worked for you?
I think it establishes the world very well. And even him being in the movie theater by himself, I thought, okay, well, he's watching Woodstock, which seems as absolutely not the movie you would be expecting. And I think a lot of that comes with our bias coming in about who Charlton Heston is. So there's a little bit of that going on. I think the world building thing, I thought that was done effectively in the beginning of it. I'm reminded of a more modern movie like 28 Days Later, where, you know, he wakes up and everything is completely desolate. And I think it did a good job with that and establishing his loneliness at the beginning, but it's automatically taken away from us when he meets Rosalind Cash's character and the other man, and then the children living in a house outside in the woods outside of Los Angeles. So it takes, you know, it takes what was good about it, his sort of loneliness, his last man, his Omega Man, and takes that away from us, takes away the tension of him being like he's the, you know, last stand against this new mutant. And also it takes away his loneliness. And so what are the stakes then after that? There doesn't really feel like there are any.
Well, picking up on what you were saying there, you know, I did enjoy the first half or the first third of this film, I think, more than sort of any other part of the movie. And I think for largely the same reasons that you did, in that it creates the world, I think, very well. It's a very economical piece of filmmaking at the start of this movie, where you see Charlton Heston driving through deserted city in an open top car, and it's quite an unsettling moment, just the stillness that's all around him, and then just suddenly pulls over and machine guns a shadowy mutant in a window. And so, you know, very quickly it sort of establishes the loneliness of him in this world, that, you know, the strangeness of the deserted city, but also you start to get an idea as to, okay, what is this threat that lurks in this world, and where you see him, you know, shopping for clothes, or just crashes his car and he just jumps into a new one. Details like that, I thought, you know, very good at kind of creating, okay, that idea of, because it is an interesting idea, okay, what, you know, what would it be like if you were the last person left on Earth? And I think the film does a sort of a good job of painting a picture of that. But I, there are some aspects about the film that I, you know, part of what makes that, I think, that part of the film much stronger is the use of location shooting. And there's a lot of use, unfortunately, within this film of backlots and studio sets. And I don't know what you thought. I just thought those studio sets looked so cheap, so nasty. There was almost no attempt to integrate them into the kind of real world footage that they'd shot. And it was interesting looking at the career of the director. He'd mostly worked in television, and that's what a large part of this film looks like. It looks like 1970s television, and I think that really hurts the film.
Yeah, it loses itself when it starts going on backlot and sets. Its strongest points are, and again, getting back to what I like about 70s movies, shot on location. It's a strong point of it when we do have those shots, and it definitely weakens. And it's very, when it's noticeable, that's awful. You know, it's when you can see very clearly and that it's a set or a backlot set. It's just, it's not great. But I do want to give credit to something, one other thing in the movie, and it's not necessarily something that it did, it's something that it didn't do. And we mentioned the sort of world building of this and establishing his loneliness. It didn't do something that I think a lot of other movies which would do, something very lazy, which would be like a text crawl at the beginning or newspapers telling you what happened. So I'm glad that it didn't resort to that, but it's hard giving credit to a movie for not doing something unless they specifically said, yeah, we didn't want to do that. But I'm just like, I'm giving you credit for something you didn't do.
Yeah, I mean, given some of the active choices that this film makes, I think it's a difficult one to start giving it credit for things that it doesn't do, because you I think we rightly skeptical as to whether how intentional that those decisions actually were. There was another aspect which I thought really hurt the atmosphere in the film, but I'd be interested to know where you land on it, because you know, from doing my research, I can see that there are some people who have completely different opinion to myself on this. But I was going to ask you about the soundtrack by Ron Granger. I thought it was awful. Some people out there love it. I really can't understand why. So, you know, I guess this is the dividing issue here. I mean, where did you fall on the soundtrack?
I'm not a fan of it. so but relieved. The thing is, it's probably one of the most divisive aspects of this film is the soundtrack, because like you, I saw a handful of reviews that said the soundtrack is great, it fits the movie perfectly, and then there were others who said the soundtrack is atrocious. I'm on the atrocious side of it. I don't care for it at all. I think there's a lot of times when the scene is supposed to be very tension filled and the score does not fit in with it at all when it's trying to be romantic or have a moment between Heston and Cash. It's overly cheesy. But at the same time, there's a lot of things in the 70s that are like that. It's over the top and cheesy and but it does not work for me at all. I'm with you.
Well, I'm very relieved to hear that. So we have already mentioned the other versions that exist of this film. So, I thought it would be interesting to compare versions. I mean, you've also read the novel that this is based on. So I guess, having read read that book and, seen, I think, quite a few of the adaptations, how do you think this film stacks up against the novel? And what do you think of the other versions of the films that we've seen so far?
I think Omega Man just takes the basic premise from I Am Legend, the novel, and pretty much just decides to do its own thing. Last Man on Earth is probably the most faithful adaptation, full-length feature, although they're more sort of, it does have the two different levels of the mutants, or we'll call them, they're sort of, you've got the first level, which are the ones who are outside of his house terrorizing him, that are more a hybrid of zombies and vampires, because they're not very smart. They're sort of lethargic, but they abide the vampire rules of no daylight and drinking blood. There's another, and the thing that those two have in common too is being killed by a spear at the end, which is, I'm pressed to remember how Neville dies in the novel. He dies in the novel, and the last line of it is "I am Legend," and that's my main problem with, because I got the ending of the Will Smith one spoiled for me, and I didn't watch it. And so when I found out what the legend was in that version, I was like, well, I'm not seeing that. There's a Mexican version called Soy Leyenda. It's not a full length feature. It's only about 40 minutes long. It's on a website called Rare Film with two M's.com, the Cave of Forgotten Films, if anyone is interested in watching it. And that's 1967, so just a few years after Last Man on Earth, but before The Omega Man. And that's probably the most literal translation or adaptation, rather, from the book to the film, minus, I don't believe that one has the dog in it, but it's almost like a exact, they took the book and just turned it exactly into a screenplay without really changing anything, including the woman who comes to him, who he thinks is another human, but turns out to be one of the higher level mutant zombie vampires in disguise. And then, like I mentioned, I haven't seen the Will Smith version, and I also have not seen the Asylum version, which of course they had to cash in and release I Am Omega the same year as I Am Legend. I'm not going to watch an Asylum film though. So if I had to rank, Last Man on Earth would be my favorite. Soy Leyenda would be close second after that. And I guess Omega Man would be last, having not seen the other two there.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
He brings the popcorn. She brings the roses. Subject Cinema, a tasty new film topic each week with a side order of film reviews.
Yum.
T.C. Kirkham.
Ba-dum-ching.
Kim Brown.
What?
Over 500,000 listeners, and you could be the next one. SubjectCinema.com.
Real movies for real people.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs in a flashback to events when the virus is first taking hold across America. Heston, an army colonel, is happily rotoring along to another laboratory in a Bell 47G-2, if you want to know these things. As the helicopter is mid-flight, the pilot suddenly succumbs to the virus and slumps down dead in the cockpit. Heston is unable to control the ailing chopper, which plummets from the sky and crashes at speed into the ground with explosive effect. This mostly happens off-screen. Then when we cut back, it's to a shot of Heston crawling rather miraculously away from the wreckage. So, Erica, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
It happens behind a tree, and then there's like a flash explosion. And it's, you know, I like to see my helicopters explode in midair. Like, please blow up a real helicopter here, model or real. As soon as it flew behind the trees, I was like, oh, here comes the exploding helicopter. I don't think it's great. I think I would rather see, I was trying to think like if I would rather see like just bad CGI explosion over one, but no, like it's not great.
Yeah. What about it's not a good one. It's not a good one. As you say, they employ that very worn out older trope or trick of having the helicopter disappear behind some sort of, geographical landmark, so that they can then, return the helicopter back to its rightful owner and disguise the fact that they haven't really exploded anything at all. I tend to, in a film of this age, I tend to accept that type of cheat. But they could have exploded a model helicopter, or they could have had it crash. They could have had Charlton Heston sort of crawl out and then exploded, something that they had made up to look like a real helicopter, which, would have provided a bit more of a realistic scene for us. But instead, they just go for this bit of a conventional cheat here. Mm-hmm. And that the effect of that does make Charlton Heston's survival rather miraculous, because you see that explosion happen behind the ridge, obviously, but you still see this big old plume of flames going up, and then cuts to this very badly damaged helicopter, and you're wondering, well, how did Heston get out of that?
I thought the same thing. If they would have had a shot of him jumping onto a tree or something next to it before it exploded, then I could believe he survived. But seeing that wreckage, my first thought was, how is he alive and with no broken anything? So, yeah.
Although in the in defense of this exploding helicopter, I guess you could argue that it does play a pivotal moment in the film, because after it crashes, we see Heston, crawling around on the ground, and he then chooses that particular moment to inject himself with the vaccine that he has developed. So that is the reason that Heston is the last man on Earth, because his character is this army colonel involved in biological weapons research, and he's trying to develop a vaccine to this, and that's the reason why he survives, and the reason he injects himself is because of the exploding helicopter. So it does actually play a kind of important part in the plot of this film.
I'll give it that. The exploding helicopter is for plot convenience. So, yes.
Okay. Well, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Erica, thanks for joining me here today. Do you want to take a moment to tell people where they can find you online and, how they can listen in to the podcast that you have got going on?
Sure. So both podcasts, Customers Also Watched and Unsung Horrors, are on any podcast platform, wherever you listen. You can follow Customers Also Watched on Twitter at CAW Podcast, Facebook or Instagram under Customers Also Watched. And then Unsung Horrors is just at Unsung Horrors on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And then you can also follow me on Letterboxd under the username Also Watched.
Great. As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website for more reviews and information on films where helicopters explode. We'll be back soon, but until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
lucky today. Believe me, I was lucky. He tried a gambit, and it almost worked. But ended up a stalemate. With a family down three pawns. What do you think his next move will be? End games are always full of surprises, aren't they? Well, my move, huh? Discovery check. How does that grab you, Caesar? Your move, Imperator.